You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Hello, hello. How's it going? Where are you?
What? Where are we? We're in blustery London, sitting outside. Lionel looks cold. There are ducks in the background. Might hear them at some point. You'll be in your Berlin cafe, Daniel.
I mean, yeah, Rosenthaler Platz. That will mean nothing to you, but yeah, in Berlin. Anyway.
Good. Well, listen, we're going to keep this week's podcast fairly short and snappy, if we can do that. That's a challenge for us. But we've got a lot going on this week. We've got a cycling podcast, Femina, coming out. That'll be out already. With myself, Orla Shinoui, and Steve Fry, also interviews with Anna van der Breggen and others in that. We've also got your, is it five-parter, Lionel?
It is indeed. Kicks off on Thursday morning, five parts from Flanders.
The Lionel of Flanders.
The Lionel of Flanders. We still haven't come up with a better title than that, thanks to Tom Wally, our producer, for that title. Yeah, I'm off to go and witness Dwarsdorf Vlaanderen and the Grand Prix E3 Harelbeke and Gent-Wevelgem. Travelling around on a bike.
Gent Wevelgem, full name please.
In Flanders Fields.
Apparently, that's
Being rebranded. Well, that will all be explained and covered in probably the final part of the five-parter. This is a series for friends of the podcast. It's kicking off on Thursday morning and runs until Monday morning. Quite short, snappy episodes, capturing a bit of the flavour of Flanders. Quite looking forward to it. Travelling on a bike, living on a boat. What can possibly go wrong, eh, Rich?
Sounds great. And you've got all your science and sport products with you. I know. You're not going to go hungry, are you?
No, I mean, I could probably live on that alone. The amount they sent to me. Very nice.
I think that's a plan. We're in budget for.
It's extraordinary what the science and sport products have done to your hair, judging from the publicity from the material we've released for the Lionel in Flanders.
Amazing.
Lionel of Flanders, sorry.
Well,
you're glistening, mate. This is sporting now.
I still don't know who has created this image of my face amid Peter Sagan's hair.
The most remarkable thing.
That's pretty much what I looked like in 1992, for those who.
The most remarkable thing is the hairline, which would put even Jakob Fuglsang to shame. The hairline starts about a centimetre above the eyebrows. Anyway.
Not a lot of forehead going on there, is there? Anyway, there is now.
Anyway, all right, let's press on.
Listen, we've got an exciting race to talk about, Milan-San Remo. But before we do, let's have the weekly news roundup, please, Lionel.
Thanks very much, Richard. Yeah, the first monument of the season, Milano San Remo, was won by Michal Kwiatkowski of Team Sky. It was Peter Sagan's attack on the Poggio that drew the response from Kwiatkowski and Julian Alaphilippe of, I nearly said Etix there, Quickstep Floors. Not bad, a couple of months into the season, get their team name right. The three of them rode over the top and then flew down the other side to fight out the sprint in San Remo. There was barely anything to separate them on the line, but Kwiatkowski edged out Sagan to give Poland their first monument victory and hand Sagan his sixth second place of the year so far. For the Polish rider, it was his second big win in Italy this season after the Strada Bianca earlier this month. Alexander Krzysztof won the bunch sprint ahead of a stream of top sprinters with Fernando Gaviria, Arnaud Demar, John Degenkolb, Nasser Buhani, Elia Viviani and Caleb Ewan rounding out the top 10. In the Women's World Tour race at the weekend, the Trofeo Alfredo Binder, also in Italy, there was a stunning win for Team Sunweb's 24-year-old American Corinne Rivera. In Belgium, the Nokia de Cursa was won by the Cofidis sprinter Buhani ahead of Aqua Blue's British champion Adam Blythe. Blythe was also second at the Hanzema Classic 2 days later, this time behind 20-year-old Norwegian Christopher Halvorsen, who won the men's under-23 road race world title in Doha last October. This week there's a lot of racing. The Volta a Catalunya stage race is underway and it's got a very strong field of stage racers, including the Tour de France champion Chris Froome and his Sky teammate Geraint Thomas. There's also Alejandro Valverde, Adam Yates, Rowan Dennis, TJ Van Garderen, Alberto Contador, Roman Bardet and a host of other climbers taking part there. There is a bit of other news about the Volta a Catalunya, which is the oldest stage race in Spain. Started in 1911, and it's the latest race to be added to ASO's increasingly impressive portfolio. The Tour de France organisers are continuing to strengthen their presence in Spain. A few years ago, they took a stake in the Vuelta a España. This race has survived largely thanks to support from the Catalan government, but now it has the might of ASO behind it. This week, the Classic Specialists will have their eyes on Belgium, where there are three World Tour races for the men and two for the women, with Gent-Wevelgem on Sunday. Off the bike, in an interview with the BBC's Dan Rowan, former Team Sky rider Josh Edmondson admitted that he had sourced needles in order to inject vitamins, which is a breach of the UCI's no needles medical regulation, although it's not breaching a WADA rule. That's the World Anti-Doping Agency. Edmondson, who joined Sky in 2013 after impressing at the 2012 Tour of Britain while riding for Great Britain, also admitted using tramadol, a painkiller that's not actually banned. He said that using tramadol caused him to become depressed. Edmondson left Sky at the end of 2014 and his last race was a Tour of Poland, and that's where he was caught with the needles and vitamins by an unnamed teammate. He rode for the Irish Anpost team in 2015 and NFTO last year, but hasn't done a major race since May. The issue is that Sky didn't report this incident either to the UK Anti-Doping Agency or the UCI. And the team's head of medical, Dr. Steve Peters, said in an interview with the BBC that he had been concerned about Edmondson's mental health and that reporting him to the authorities might have made matters worse. The UCI is now assessing the situation and we expect to hear about that in due course. There's some sad news in that Roger Pangeon, the 1967 Tour de France champion, has died from a reported heart attack at his home in France, aged 76. Pangeon finished 8th in his first Tour de France in 1966 and rode the 1967 Tour for the French team. That year the race was contested by national teams instead of trade teams. Anyway, he took the yellow jersey after winning stage 5 and held it for all but one day all the way to Paris. The 67 Tour was overshadowed by the death of his Peugeot trade teammate Tom Simpson on Mont Ventoux, though. Pangeon won the 1969 Vuelta a España and finished second in the Tour later that year. He retired in the mid-70s and in later life worked as a pundit on both French and Swiss television.
Thank you very much for that news roundup, Lionel, with nice background music. The music, we changed our music last week. That caused a lot of controversy, didn't it?
Well, I wasn't prepared for the
ongoing
for the backlash. Can we call it a backlash?
Yeah.
Certainly had a lot of messages. It doesn't seem universally popular at the moment, but I think it will grow on people, won't it?
Well, we did run a Twitter poll with a series of strange response. Not sure was the decisive winner, ironically.
Yeah, this was a bit of a Trumpian Twitter poll, though, wasn't it? Because all of the answers were broadly
quite
speaking
positive.
Yeah,
like
but
podcast,
maybe we'll,
you know?
We'll give it a while to bed in. People may get used to it, or they may not.
The interesting thing is, we didn't know how much you loved our previous music by Glass Pear until we changed it, and we might go back to it. We're open to that. We, you know, we will listen to our audience, We are democratic. In a few weeks, we might run another poll. Or Daniel suggested putting out two different episodes with the different music, and the one that gets the most listens will be the music that we stick with. I'm not sure about that.
But the thing is, we're changing the music for the Giro and the Tour, aren't we? So yeah, if you really don't like it, you're kind of stuck with it for now, unfortunately.
We're open to changing it back. Let's see how it goes. Give it a chance, though. That's all we ask. So, chaps, Milan-San Remo, you mentioned that obviously in your news roundup, Lionel. The fantasy Milan-San Remo is probably for the move to go on the Poggio. And we rarely see it. We see attacks, but we rarely see a move go and stick. And I've watched several times now Peter Sagan's move. There was a slowing up of Tom Dumoulin had obviously done his bit. There was a slowing up at the front. The two Sky riders kind of eased up a little bit. And Sagan, in that moment, seemed to recognise there was an opportunity. And boy, did he go.
Yeah, he really did go, didn't he? And that's what we were anticipating. I did listen to the two of you talking ahead of the race about what Sagan's tactics might be. And obviously, as the rider he is, all eyes were on him. The key thing was the identity of the two riders that were so quick to react, Michał Kwiatkowski and Julian Alaphilippe. I mean, that really was a trio of A-listers, wasn't it? You can't really ask for more than that. Three of the best, most dynamic, most attacking types of riders all getting together. And then, of course, it was the conundrum who will work with Peter Sagan. And really, it was that strange moment when Alaphilippe committed a little bit that surprised me, because was there really any incentive? Was there really any reason for the two of them to work with him? Kwiatkowski, it worked out perfectly.
Daniel, I'll bring you in a moment, because last week, of course, you said that the best thing for Sagan to do would be to exercise some patience and wait and wait and wait. And I guess what you can look back on the performance, certainly, and the spectacular nature of it, and say, well, he did the right thing, and he came very, very close to winning. But he was so strong. I mean, they almost didn't catch him on the climb. He was going so hard. It was Sonny Colbrelli and John Degenkolb who immediately tried to follow him, and Kwiatkowski and Alaphilippe were just behind. And they had to make a huge, huge effort, dig very deep indeed, just to make contact with Sagan, which was extraordinary to watch. But I just wonder, given that Sagan was clearly in such incredible form, the one mistake I think he made was he started a sprint too soon. But in an alternative scenario, had he waited for the sprint, which was won in the end by Christoph, would he have won the race?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say, or you know, to go back on what we were discussing last week about alternative tactics, or the alternative to waiting for the sprint, whether that meant an attack on the bottom of the Poggio descent or an attack on the Poggio, perhaps wasn't the best way for Sagan to win the race. But his interview to Rai, the Italian television network, at the end of the race really shed light on what his priorities are these days and how he sort of rationalises his racing. And he said results don't really... He laughed at the interviewer when the interviewer said that he perhaps should have waited for the sprint. He laughed and said, well, results don't really matter to me. It's more important to put on a show. So he seemed, you know, fairly happy to have done that. I mean, just as regards attacks succeeding on the Poggio, I mean, the last 20-odd years, I counted four that have really gone on the Poggio, authentic attacks, and guys have gone as a la pedal, as we say, really beaten people with strength and speed on the Poggio, and that move has then gone to the finish. I didn't count Pozzato in 2006, because he was actually caught, and then he attacked again, countered again. But the two common ingredients, real key ingredients that I identified were the presence of one, well, two or more exceptional descenders in the break, and it really underlined again how important the descent off the Poggio is. The fact that Kwiatkowski was there and Sagan as well, two of the best descenders in professional cycling. You look back at those previous moves, so 95, it was Jalabert and Fondriest and Jalabert, both outstanding descenders. 2003, you had Paolini, Celestino and Bettini, all renowned for their descending. 2012, you had Nibali and Cancellara with Simon Gerrans. And again, those two, probably two of the best descenders in the peloton at the time. And then the second ingredient really is the lack of any hesitation whatsoever. And what that usually has meant is that someone has to completely sacrifice themselves and not worry at all about the other guys in the group taking turns or not. That was Cancellara in 2012. It was Paolini in 2003, who was a teammate of Bettini. And in 95, it was Fondriest. He really did all of the work and let Jalabert come around him at the end. And that was Sagan on Saturday. He was pretty sort of selfish, altruistic. But I think he knew and has realised now, and has seen this scenario play out enough times in Milan-San Remo to realise that for an attack to succeed off the top of the Poggio, that is the key ingredient, the lack of any hesitation whatsoever. And you know, the conventional wisdom in about San Remo has been that you need 10 to 12 seconds at the top of the Poggio for the break to stay away. I actually think that is less important than this factor I'm talking about now, the lack of hesitation, because in 2003, Bettini, Celestino and Paolini, they only had about 5 or 6 seconds, but they went to the finish precisely because they didn't really stop and look at each other and give the peloton any chance to come back.
Hi, I'm Chris Hoy, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast, supported by Science and Sport.
Science and Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast, and for their very generous offer that they extended to all friends of the podcast over the last couple of weeks, sending them a £14 goodie bag.
Yeah. Anyone who signed up as a friend of the podcast for 2017, as long as they were based in the UK, Rich, was eligible to claim their goodie bag of Science and Sport gels. and a bottle as well.
Did I not make the terms and conditions
I think
all that clear?
Terms and conditions don't work terribly well in audio, do they? So you just didn't bother, I think, is the vibe
bit
I
of,
got.
Bit of buffalo, yeah.
Charged off and announced the offer. But yeah, just to be clear, anyone who was signed up as a friend of the podcast for 2017 before last Friday, or on last Friday, up to last Friday, and is based in the UK, is eligible to apply for the offer. Non-UK listeners, we're really sorry about that. At the moment, we can't get the gels and goodies sent out to you. But we are talking with Science and Sport about what we might be able to do a little bit later on in the year about that.
And some non-UK listeners do seem to have got them, so I'm not sure that does seem to be the case. But anyway, seen on Twitter and so on, people posting pictures.
Yeah. The lesson for listeners is when Richard announces a competition or offer, wait until it's then clarified in subsequent
anything
weeks.
Anything at all. Anything at all. Take anything I say with a pinch of salt. That's the moral of the story.
Further to the conversation about releasing two podcasts with alternative jingles or different music, and seeing which one is downloaded the most, we should also release two podcasts which feature each one of us, or three podcasts, one with your voice removed, one with Lionel's voice removed, one with my voice removed, and see how many downloads they each get, and then give whoever is the least popular co-host of the podcast will be permanently exiled.
Given how fragile each of us is, I'm not sure that would be a recipe for...
This is continuing a theme of Daniel's, of, you know, trying to establish some kind of pecking order. Don't worry, Daniel, you can have the gold medal.
Hey, before we go on to more chat about Milan Sanremo, I should mention our sponsor, Science and Sport, are offering, of course, 20% off to all our listeners. Just enter the code TCP20 at the checkout, TCP20. At scienceandsport.com, 20% off everything apart from things that are already discounted, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'd be guaranteed bronze at least, wouldn't I? I'm quite happy with that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. We're still talking about that, aren't we? Anyway, Milan Sanremo, Mikhail Kwiatkowski can really Team Sky's best ever start to a season, it has to be said, which is perhaps surprising in the circumstances, but they've won Paris-Nice, they've won Strada Bianchi, they've won Milan Sanremo, first time they won Milan Sanremo, obviously. That meant a lot, I think. Continued Kwiatkowski's very good record against Peter Sagan as well. I mean, they've been rivals for best part of a decade, and some of Kwiatkowski's best wins have come at the expense of Peter Sagan. They were away together in Strada Bianchi a couple of years ago, and also in E3, I remember. One of the few times I can remember Sagan getting the edge over Kwiatkowski, Tour of Flanders last year, I think. Kwiatkowski ran out of legs there, and Sagan went on to win it. But
and Rich, and this was their rivalry really going full circle, because I think we've mentioned on the podcast before that they locked horns several times when they were juniors and amateurs. And back then, it tended to be Kwiatkowski who would win the sprints, and Sagan who would be the stronger climber. And that's effectively, I suppose, what we saw on Saturday. Sagan attacking on the Poggio, and Kwiatkowski winning the sprint.
I mean, when you look at the two riders and the backup from their respective teams, Team Sky came into the bottom of the Poggio with pretty much everybody
six
still
riders,
there.
Six riders.
Obviously, they still had Viviani as a kind of a B card if it came back together for the sprint. I'm not convinced that he would necessarily have been...
He's got a terrible record in Sanremo as well, Lionel.
And I think although really they weren't going for the win, I think the final result bears that out. He wouldn't have troubled the likes of Christoph. But Sky was certainly impressive there. And Sagan, I mean, he really can do it on his own. I mean, I'm not saying that Bora
You say that, but I watched the race again because, as ever, Sagan paid fulsome tribute to his team afterwards. And I have to say, going into the Cipressa and the Poggio, I was very impressed by Bora and Hans Groh and the numbers they had and the sort of protection they gave him going into the... And obviously, Sagan is more than capable of fending for himself, but it was quite impressive, I thought.
Yeah, I was going to say, certainly into the Cipressa, I didn't perhaps notice as much on the Poggio, but... maybe just, you know, wasn't what I picked out. I mean, the things that the Sky train was really evident. But the other thing that struck me when the move went was it was this the fact that Colbrelli and Degenkolb were almost sort of hamstrung, weren't they, when they couldn't react quickly enough, perhaps just couldn't find that bit of speed that they needed. And it was very impressive that the other two, Alaphilippe and Kwiatkowski, were able to close that gap to Sagan. And perhaps if it had been different riders on the front, at the point that Sagan made his move, you know, it might have come back together again. But Colbrelli was kind of the, you know, he was the sort of the weak link really up there, wasn't he? What do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, and Colbrelli was the rider who, I mean, you often see this when a rider sort of tries to counter or go behind a break, and then finds that he can't follow the group. That causes all sorts of problems from the guys on his wheel, and I think in this case that was Degenkolb. Degenkolb found himself in no man's land, cut adrift, and that ended his chances. Just to go back to Kwiatkowski, who of course I'm a huge fan of, and I said it was a fantastic signing for, I think my exact words, for Team Sky last year. Interesting observation that Alessandro Petacchi made on Rai. Alessandro Petacchi, of course, former winner of San Remo, working this year for Italian TV. Two things I really enjoyed about Petacchi's punditry at the weekend. One was him calling Alan Philippe throughout. And the second thing was something he spotted in the sprint. Kwiatkowski, obviously on paper, not as fast as Peter Sagan, but he very smartly, Kwiatkowski, just when Sagan started to launch the sprint, he left a couple of metres, or he hung back a couple of metres off Sagan's wheel. And Petacchi explained that this is absolutely vital, particularly when you're going up against someone who is nominally stronger than you. It's important to pick up a bit of momentum and actually come at the rider in front at a slightly narrower angle, so you don't have to effectively dodge him to come round him, and that way you manage to get into his slipstream and keep some of the momentum that he has given you and then come round. And Kwiatkowski did that, and he did that very deliberately. You could tell he was hanging back slightly just as Sagan was about to launch his sprint, and you know that was probably the difference between him winning and losing.
Yeah, that's interesting. Cavendish, I remember when Alessandro Petacchi was his lead-out man, explained something very similar. You know, there's this a myth, I suppose, that the most sheltered position is directly behind the rider, and sometimes the sweet spot is a metre or so further back, and then, as you say, you've got a little bit more room for manoeuvre. I mean, Sagan on paper might have been the strongest or the best sprinter, but we saw at the end, I mean, few people picked up on perhaps a problem with his chain jumping a little bit, but you know the way that he lunged at the line and then almost did collide with Kwiatkowski, and almost, I don't know how he held it up, only Sagan could hold it up, but he looked like he'd, you know, given everything there. We rarely see Sagan in quite such a condition. You know, I mean, I was struck on the Poggio itself just by how incredibly relaxed he looked all the way up. It was a big group as well, wasn't it? I mean, you know, it was a 50-60 man group that made it into San Remo in the end. I don't know what that says about the race, but I was struck, you know, when you look at Sagan, you look at the build of him, you know, he's bulky. The way he just twiddled up that climb was really quite impressive. When he did go, around about the same place as Alaphilippe and Kwiatkowski were Michael Matthews and Ben Swift. You know, those guys are more sprinters than people who can follow on a climb like that, but they obviously didn't have the legs at that point.
Interesting you mentioned there about the, you know, what sort of race was it? Because in our competition last week, or rather Rafa's competition last week, to guess the winning time, I, as a guinea pig, I had a go. And I actually put quite a bit of research into my guess. I can't remember now what it was, but it was around 6 hours 52, or 6:51,
I think you said. 6:51,
and I based that on the average speed of the last 15 years worth of Milan-San Remo. Turns out that really that was wasted time doing that research, because I think these figures are correct, but it was 291 kilometres on Saturday, and they did it in 7 hours, or the winning time was 7 hours, 8 minutes and 39 seconds for an average speed of 40.73 kilometres. You have to go back to 2001 for a slower overall average speed for the winner of Milan-San Remo, when it was under 39 kilometres an hour. So it was a slowish addition. Not sure what the wind was doing, Daniel. You may be able to help me out there. But I gather that the speed on the Poggio itself was a pretty quick ascent, under 6 minutes for the Sagan group. But also, the Poggio's been resurfaced fairly recently. Is that right? Have I got all that right, or have I got all that completely wrong, Daniel?
Pretty much correct, Lionel. Just shows you what a bit of research can do. We should do that more often. The wind was blowing against. It was it was a headwind for most of the race, I understand, certainly when they got onto the coast road, the Via Aurelia, but then it didn't seem to affect the race too much, because usually that's given as an excuse for there not being more attacks on the Cipressa and certainly the Poggio, but it certainly didn't seem to deter Sagan. And I think, as you rightly say, the Poggio has been resurfaced, and that might be one reason why the ascent was very fast there. Just on Kwiatkowski, Rich, I wanted to, because I'm such a huge fan of him, and I've always been such a huge fan of him, I just wanted to dwell for a second on what this means for the rest of his, well, for the rest of his time at Team Sky and his career. I mean, I think he's really underlining the fact that he is predominantly now a one-day race rider. And in all seriousness, one of my reservations about him joining Team Sky was that, and this chimed with noises coming out of the team and also noises coming out of Kwiatkowski's camp, that one of his goals or one of his hopes joining Team Sky was for him to develop as a stage race rider. And what we've seen, certainly at the start of this season, is how adept he is in one-day races. He won Strade Bianche, he's now won Milan-San Remo, he's a very fast finisher. And it will be interesting to see which classics now he decides to target, because I think that's another question for him. I was very, very impressed with him in the early part of the Cobbled Classics last year, and then slightly disappointed when he didn't ride well in Flanders, and then again slightly disappointed when this year, at the start of the year, he was talking about focusing more on the Ardennes than the Cobbled Classics, because I think there was enough evidence last year to suggest that he really has a future in the Cobbled Classics. I'm not sure what he said, whether he said anything about that after the race on Saturday, but it'd be interesting to get your thoughts on that as well.
Well, he is so versatile. I mean, he's won the Amstel Gold Race for hell of a CV he's got, hasn't he? He's not like Sagan has got so many top threes. Kwiatkowski has been far more clinical. When he's had a result, it's been a big result, and he's now got on his CV, he's got two Strade Bianche, he's got Milan San Remo, he's got Amstel Gold Race, he's got E3, and he's got a world title. Other races he could win, Tour of Flanders he could win, Liège-Bastogne-Liège he could probably win, Flèche Wallonne, not sure, but certainly, you know, Liège-Bastogne-Liège is within his capabilities. The one probably not is Paris-Roubaix. He could probably win the Tour of Lombardy as well, couldn't he? Almost certainly. Did you have something else to say there, Lionel?
Well, Daniel, we were asked a question on Twitter on Saturday by K Millard 68. And he said, I kind of get breakaways in a stage race.
Or just
race.
K Millard.
K Millard, 68.
Is that the full name? Millard, 68.
That's KM1806 is down as his name, his or her name. I mean, that's all I've got to go on. I mean, you can only deal with the evidence in front of you. Millard, 68. I kind of get breakaways in a stage race, but what's the actual point in an all-or-nothing one-day race? And obviously, we saw that 10-rider break go reasonably early on, and it never really got a great deal of headway. And particularly with then, Daniel, with the wind blowing against, it does raise that question, you know, what is the point? And I suppose I was struggling a little bit to think of an answer. It's convention, really, and just the you know, there is a tactical advantage for teams having a rider up the road a little bit. It sort of basically takes any responsibility off the chase, you know, behind, give as much of an easy day as possible for your teammates. But really, I suppose you never know. It might get lucky. I mean, I can't remember the last time a break went from the start to the finish of Milan-San Remo.
Chiappucci.
It might well be Chiappucci, yeah, or the probably the famous one, 1982, Marc Gomez, who was a complete unknown at the time, French rider, only been a professional 3 months, I think. It was one of his first, well, certainly his first big win. It doesn't happen very often in the big classics, but there's always that chance. You never know if a break gets 10, 11 minutes up the road and throws a sense of uncertainty behind, they might get lucky. But Daniel, any other sort of reasons why, other than just it's the done thing, isn't it? Somebody has to get up the road to at least set the format for the race.
Yeah, I think so. And generally it is no-hopers. It is teams that don't have an awful lot of hope of winning the race overall. I think riders are generally very realistic about their capabilities, particularly in a race that everyone knows so well, and everyone knows how fast the best guys go on the Poggio and how fast they go on the Cipressa and exactly what it takes to win Milan-San Remo. So I don't think anyone is in under any illusions as they come into the race about what their chances are likely to be. I mean, it's described as the easiest classic to finish but the hardest to win. And it's often referred to as a democratic classic in that respect. And you know, maybe 20, 30, 40 guys do come in thinking that they can win, but for the others, it really is a question of either helping a team leader or, in the case of, you know, small teams, perhaps, you know, Nippo Vinifantini, that kind of team. It's a question of maybe, well, of getting your face and your sponsor's logo on TV. I remember there are some nice little anecdotes I've heard in the past, stories about guys who do get an in the morning breakaway in Milan-San Remo. I remember Filippo Simeone a few years ago, maybe 10 or more years ago. Filippo Simeone, of course, who became famous for his running with Lance Armstrong in 2004 Tour de France. He was in a breakaway early one day in a Milan-San Remo, and when he and his fellow and his breakaway companions were caught, they actually stopped at the side of the road and they went for an ice cream together. And I think they all finished the race, but the other alternative for riders who are caught is they often actually don't ride the Cipressa or the Poggio, and they just carry on along the coast road. And of course, they're considered to have abandoned the race, and they register DNFs at that point. But yeah, they're the three options open for you: stop for an ice cream, carry on along the coast road, or actually ride the course.
Hi, I'm Lara. My job is pro teams marketing, so working with all our teams and athletes. My experience of Canyon SRAM specifically is just that they're this wonderful group of women that, just like Rafa, have this aspiration to get more people on bikes. They have all come from very different backgrounds, and it's really wonderful to see the spread across the globe all coming together in a team. As soon as you start asking them about cycling, you feel this switch go, and they have this killer instinct and drive to win, and a single-mindedness about the job at hand. And that's the thing that I have found across the board with cyclists.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Sometimes when I look at the young guys and see that they've got 10, 12 years, I'm a bit jealous of that. That you're going to be lining up at these big races, rolling into that amphitheatre at Brugge to start Flanders. You know, it's spine tingling, rolling down the start of in Compiègne and heading off on a Roubaix and getting to the Velodrome there. You know, that's just, it's what it's all about. It's why you do it. That's why you train for months in the winter.
Slightly downhill at this point, and Heyman has clipped onto the back. And Tom Bonan is sitting in second position.
I got knocked off and I thought it was all over, and I was wondering, you know, how far was the rest of the remnants of that group behind me with Heinrich Hausler? And I was just seeing, you know, a potential top five turning into maybe a top 10, and who knows, it could, you know, you can get rounded up on that velodrome and finish 20th.
Heyman unable to defend that front position. Bossenhagen pass as well. Stannard up the inside of Heyman, pushes him off the road, and that could be the end for Heyman.
I've said in quite a few interviews that I think Bossenhagen was just really tired in the end. And here's the moment we come around where I join back on to this front group.
Takes the right-hand turn, short across the asphalt, a left-hand turn, and on to the next section of Grusson. There's a lot of gravel sections. Heyman is back!
What a return of Matthew Heyman!
It was just instinct. This was taking me back to racing as a kid.
Here is a golden opportunity. If you're Matthew Heyman now, you've got to stay in the wheel.
Matthew Heyman has won two professional races. Tom Bonan, 109. The odds are stacked against the Australian. But the underdog has gotten up before Heyman.
You know, maybe every single time I ever rode a bike was meant for that one day.
And Edvard Bossenhagen and Stannard going to come back now at the bell.
Five up for the sprints. Tom Bonan up the top of the track. So too Matthew Heyman. He's getting the run up. He's taking advantage of the potential dive.
Go, Matty.
Momentum onto the wheel of Tom Bonan. Boesenhagen and Stannard have returns. Heyman has hit the front.
He's got to go.
Tom Bonin into the wheel, and here comes Sepp van Mark. Tom Bonin is boxed in. Heyman is leading out. It's Stannard around the outside. Heyman with his nose in front. Bonin is trying to challenge, but it's Matthew Heyman. It's an early birthday present. Heyman holding on.
Hi, I'm Matthew Heyman, and you're listening to the Cycling Podcast Friends Special about how I won Paris-Roubaix in 2016.
So we heard there from our sponsor, Rafa. Thank you very much indeed to them for their support. And following the message from Rafa, we heard a little trailer for forthcoming Friends Special, actually our third of the year, if we include your five mini specials as one, Lionel.
Which we do.
So the Lionel Flanders will come in the next few days, and then a couple of weeks later, just before Paris-Roubaix, we'll hear the special with Matt Heyman talking about his victory in last year's race.
Yeah, I've listened through this, Rich, and had nothing but good things to say about it. Really very insightful. Quite rare to hear a rider talk in such detail and offer so much insight into what was going through his mind as he was trying to win the race. And of course, it nearly slipped away from him a couple of times. And just listening to Heyman talk about a race which will, when he's old and grey and
he's already quite old.
Well, I was trying to be kind, Rich. Right. A rider who will look back on that as undoubtedly the crowning moment of a career spent largely in service to other riders. It was quite a moving listen in places as well.
It puts a whole new sort of gloss on his career. And what we did was we sat and watched the final 20 kilometres of the race. It was the first time he'd seen it. He'd intended to watch the whole race with his wife over the winter, but they never got round to it.
Yeah, and listening to the second half of that episode, Rich, whilst watching the last 20 kilometres on YouTube, it just takes it to a whole new dimension. So if you haven't signed up as a friend of the podcast yet, maybe that's the episode that will tempt you to do so. It's only £10 and you get at least 11 special episodes. Well, certainly more than 11 special episodes, because I'm doing five of them later this week.
And we've got others following, coming up, a couple around the Giro, which we're looking forward to as well. Giro, of course, will be doing daily coverage again. Once again, we're committed to all three Grand Tours.
And I hope it's warmer in Italy than it is here in London.
Lionel
now.
And I will be drifting in and out of the Giro. Daniel will be our man on the ground for the whole 3 weeks. It's really your race, isn't it, Daniel, the Giro?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Very decisive, yeah.
Great. I booked all the hotels anyway.
Yeah, you booked all the hotels.
That, some of them look very nice, Daniel. I hope they're within budget.
I'm glad you've looked.
Oh yeah, I'm
very flattered that you've actually looked.
First thing I did, Daniel, was check them all out.
I've looked even.
Some of the restaurants look quite nice as well, that the hotels have. Anyway,
I, on the other hand, was aghast. I've told you that I was aghast. You've booked a couple of premier class hotels for the Tour de France. Anyway.
Well, premier class is basically a hotel chain that doesn't live up to its name. Not only are they budget, they're really budget. But
save on hotel, spend on dinner is Lionel's motto.
Booking a premier class is on page one in the textbook of heinous crimes of the Tour de France. Also, or alongside or underneath staying in Lourdes at any point for any reason.
I completely agree with you, but when they're within sight of the start line or finish line, I think, there's
Lionel,
definitely mitigating factors.
No excuses.
Lionel, Daniel, no speaking excuses, of heinous like crimes, speaking of heinous crimes, last week you said that Fernando Gaviria finished fifth in Milan-San Remo last year.
Well, he did finish fifth. He finished fifth on Saturday. I was ahead of the game, Rich. I was ahead. Everything I say,
I didn't pull you up on it. But he did crash
everything
last
I
year.
Say in the podcast becomes relevant a year later. I'm a visionary. Anyway.
he was fifth when he crashed, I think, wasn't he? Is that just about get away with that? Maybe.
I should have spotted that, but I didn't even realise he'd actually ridden Milan-San Remo last year, so there you go. Anyway, that's Milan-San Remo, first monument of the year. It certainly served up a cracking race. Any other business this week, chaps? Did we want to go there on the Josh Edmondson story, the latest installment of the Team Sky story. Daniel, you had a few thoughts about the Josh Edmondson story, which Lionel mentioned briefly in his news roundup at the start.
Yeah, I won't go into it in too much detail, but just a couple of, well, bits of housekeeping, really. A couple of points I think it's worth making. A couple of people pulled out comments from Rod Ellingworth, who's the coach at Team Sky, post Team Sky letting Josh Edmondson go. And Rod Ellingworth commented on his lack of professionalism or lack of organisation. And it was sort of alleged or claimed that, you know, this wasn't very compassionate towards Josh Edmondson, when one of the reasons, or the main reason that Team Sky supposedly didn't disclose the fact that Edmondson had been caught with syringes at the Tour of Poland, was that he might have been at risk of having mental health issues. And you know, there was talk, or the suspicion, or people suggesting that there might have been a cover-up, and that Team Sky had used his lack of professionalism as a cover story for what was in fact the real reason for them getting rid of him, which was this incident at Tour of Poland. It was something that we heard about Josh Edmondson, unfortunately, throughout his time, or certainly in the second half of his 2 years at Team Sky, that there were issues with organisation. And I think, to be honest, he gave a couple of interviews after leaving Team Sky when he joined Anne Post the following year, where he was pretty honest and pretty candid about having not taken all of the opportunities offered to him at Team Sky, and maybe even hinting himself at his lack of maturity or organisation, professionalism in certain aspects of his career at Team Sky. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that, just as regards this attempt to use needles or to inject himself with vitamins, it brought to mind for me Ivan Basso's attempt to use blood transfusions, or supposed attempt, in 2006. Ivan Basso was sort of caught red-handed in Operación Puerto, but then he told the media that he hadn't actually used blood bags, and it was something that he was thinking about doing. But as far as the letter of the law was concerned, that didn't make any difference. Any attempt to dope was sanctionable in the same way as doping itself. And that is partly relevant here, because the no needle rule, which Josh Edmondson seems to have violated in this case, that does not fall within the remit of anti-doping. It's the UCI brought this rule in 2011, but it's not part of, well, it doesn't come under the umbrella of the WADA code. However, some of the same conditions, some of the same provisos apply, and I'll just read out something that is in the regulations about the no-needle rule. A first offence of the new rule can result in a suspension from 8 days to 6 months and or a fine. If a violation occurs at a race, the whole team of the licence holder involved may be excluded from the race. Just the possession of objects used or fit for an injection is presumed to constitute evidence of a violation of the regulations. So effectively, what that tells us is that Josh Edmondson had already committed an offence by having the syringes. However, the fact that this doesn't fall under the umbrella of the WADA code and anti-doping regulations also tells us that should there, for example, exist a clause in Sky's contract with the team which says that Sky can terminate sponsorship if there is an anti-doping offence, that does not apply here. So anyone hoping or thinking or wondering whether this could be, as far as the sponsor is concerned, a smoking gun, it could be the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of support, the team support of Dave Brailsford and so forth. That, strictly speaking, would not be the case, because we're not talking about an anti-doping violation here.
No, but the UCI are looking into it, aren't they, Daniel? And we hope that they will come to some kind of conclusion fairly quickly. Certainly, I hope they'll come to some kind of conclusion quicker than they're managing to put me in touch with the UCI president, Brian Cookson. They requested an interview a few weeks ago and was told that...
He's very busy,
because
Lionel.
He's very busy. Brian's very busy.
I know he's
traveling.
Busy, because I've been following him on Strava.
Well, this is what I was going to... I didn't necessarily want to dob you in as the source of this, but yeah, Brian Cookson has had time to do 6 3/4 hours on his bike in the past week, But he hasn't yet had time to do an interview with the Cycling Podcast. We'd love to talk to him about a few things that happened in 2011 when he was president of British Cycling. Hopefully the UCI's press office will be putting us in touch with him soon.
Well, watch this space.
Listen to this space.
Listen to this space. Yeah, we look forward to that. Should we wrap things up for this week? We're very cold.
Wrap me up. I'm freezing.
Very cold. Spring is here.
Lionel, has Brian Cookson spent more time on bike rides in the last since January the 20th than Donald Trump has spent at Mar-a-Lago playing golf? That's what I would like to know. And if so, is this not something we should be applauding and welcoming? Because, you know, he's the president of the UCI. He should be riding his bike.
Don't get
me
wrong. I fully support Brian Cookson's indulging in his leisure activity. Cycling is a wonderful thing. I've been doing a fair bit of cycling myself in preparation for the Lionel of Flanders. But I do think that his silence on a number of matters lately is not... it's not quite... how he pledged to be as president of the UCI, is it? He did usher in an era of transparency and openness, and we've not witnessed an awful lot of that in recent weeks. I appreciate that things are ongoing, and they don't want to say anything that may prejudice inquiries and investigations. But I do think that, you know, strong leadership requires taking the harder path at times.
Devil's advocate, would it be appropriate for him? What you want to talk to him about in particular is his time at British Cycling as president, when, you know, there was this arrangement between Sky and British Cycling and this overlap, how things were managed, what kind of culture was in place. Would it be appropriate for him to talk about that while the UK anti-doping investigation is ongoing? I mean, really, would it be the right thing for him to do?
Possibly not, but it's appropriate for us to ask and to keep asking whether Brian's available, and so we'll keep doing that.
On that point, Rich, although Brian Cookson has not been available for an interview, and we hope he will be at some point in the not too distant future, the UCI did release this statement on Brian Cookson's behalf, and it says the UK sport and UK anti-doping inquiries into British Cycling and Team Sky are important to help our sport continue to learn from the past and move forward. However, as these inquiries are still ongoing, it would not be appropriate to comment on them at this time.
Let's just go for a bike round Ron Eagle. You're bound to bump into him. Anyway,
it goes a bit too slowly.
Fighting talk. Anyway, we should wrap things up there. As I say, this has been, or we're in the midst of a busy week. We've had the Cycling Podcast Femina, the March episode out this week. We've got a bit of a family's theme going on there. We've got interview with Abby Mae Parkinson, daughter of Lisa Brambani. We've got the Backsteads, Magnus and Eleanor. And the Dreitz sisters, the four Belgian sisters who all ride for the Top Sport team. That's fun. And your special's coming up, Lionel. So anyway, that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
The Cycling Podcast in association with RAFA. Find us on Twitter @cycling_podcast. And also on Facebook and Instagram.